tonight on Arena. Nicolas Cage goes truffle hunting in Pig, and Niamh Algar finds a lost sister in the horror film Censor. You can text on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. We start as usual on Thursdays with film reviews. First up, The Bright Side, a story about a group of women coming to terms with cancer diagnoses and subsequent treatment for the disease. With a script by director Ruth Meehan and Jean Paisley, it's loosely based on a memoir by Irish comedian Anne Gildee. Next up, Pig, an American drama starring Nicolas Cage, directed by and co-written by Michael Sarnofsky. His directorial debut, in fact. The movie centres on Robin, played by Nicolas Cage, who has turned his hand to foraging for truffles, but encounters a crisis when his much-loved pig goes missing. And finally, Censor, a British horror film set in 1985 and starring Niamh Algar as a film censor who discovers an eerie link between a horror movie that she vets and her sister's mysterious disappearance. Tara Brady and Darrell Jones have seen all three and are with me now. But let's start with The Bright Side, directed by Ruth Meehan, who co-wrote the script along with Jean Paisley, focusing on the trials and tribulations of a group of women coming to terms with their treatment for cancer. Tara, first of all, a little background to the movie. It's based on a memoir by the comedian and former member of the Newlas, Anne Gildee. What was the book about and how is the film different?
Well, it draws very heavily on that memoir. It's not any kind of straight adaptation, but it also incorporates material from the director's own life. And the director and co-writer Ruth Meehan had her own experiences with a sister who died of cancer. So it brings together those two things. So you end up with, for example, a strand through the film, which is sometimes used as light or comic relief and sometimes used as a way to convey of how she's really feeling, the main character is really feeling. You have these little excerpts of her stand-up routines, which are very, very illustrative, and they also like add greatly, I think, to the overall narrative. So you have all these things coming together. And then a huge amount of it relies, I think, on the central performance. It also draws, I think, a little bit on a kind of genre that's mostly a very masculine genre, which is the kind of group of men coming together. I mean, we've seen it a lot of times in war movies, especially, I suppose, things like Full Metal Jacket, but also in movies like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which have a kind of medical strand to them in the way that this one does.
Yes. Well, let's listen to a clip which will show that mix you're saying between getting chemo and also the fact that the central character, Kate, is a stand-up comic. So she's just started chemo and she has built a little comic routine around it. Later in this clip as well, you'll hear how her comedian friends react to the reaction she gets at the comedy club.
So what does having chemotherapy actually entail? I'm hooked up like a prisoner in a cell with all these other people that I don't know and that I would rather not know. But apparently it's absolutely essential that we stay positive. Speaking of positive, Auntie Eileen sent me a voucher for a treatment of Reiki with the angels. Reiki with the angels. For fuck's sake, 90 bloody euros she paid. Not so smart, my mother's side of the family. Anyway, it was paid for, so I went. And the therapist actually said to me, I sense your cancer has something to do with your unexpressed rage. Shove your Reiki up your gaping chakras, I told her, loud and clear. No problem expressing my rage, me.
Imagine if a man made a joke about chemotherapy.
I did jokes about having chlamydia. No laughs.
Who's Lydia?
Ah, here she is now. New material and free drugs. Some people have all the luck.
Jim and Lee Devereaux is the Kate in question, and Garrod Fallery, John Collarin and David Riley are the stand-up comedians there in that clip from The Bright Side. Daryl, the drama centres around Kate, the stand-up comedian, but she is, even though we see her in comedy mode there, she is very jaded with life, and this chemo diagnosis lays very heavily on her.
That's right. So as Tara says, I think the film stands and falls on its central performance, and Gemma Leigh Devereaux is great. I think Kate, the comedian, she's smart, she's articulate, she's edgy, but she's also kind of vulnerable and defensive and assertive, and all of these things at the same time. And she, you know, is initially highly resistant to the idea, the diagnosis, but also the treatment. And the film charts through her kind of growing friendship with these four very disparate women that she finds herself sharing a ward with. Charts her acceptance of both her disease, but also of herself, I think.
And can you give us a pen picture of the other characters that she meets in the chemo group and the chemist who then comes into their lives?
Yeah, so you know, in some ways, what we have here is quite close to being a collection of stereotypes, and I think it's to the film's credit, but also I think to the credit of the actors involved, that they transcend these stereotypes. So that we have Karen Egan as a kind of snobby suburban wealthy housewife who could have been a comic grotesque, I think, but ended up as my favourite character in the film. I was very happy whenever she was on screen. There's Siobhan Cullen is a kind of working class intellectual college graduate who is very angry with the world as a consequence. Dervla Crotty is a lesbian who thinks that she's wasted. She says she's wasted the first half of her life by not coming out. And then Barbara Brennan is an older woman, an older married woman who's kept going by her faith. So in some ways, what we're meant to see here is a cross section of Irish society or Irish women, and as I say, there is something kind of stereotypical about them. But I enjoyed being in their company, as you know, they go on this rather surreal fishing trip, and get drunk and get stoned and tell rude stories and rude jokes. I mean, I felt a little as though I shouldn't be listening to some of these, but nevertheless, I did enjoy it.
Yes, Tara, that's where the character Tom Vaughan Lawler plays comes in. Tell us about his role in the film.
Well, he's such a most important player in so many projects, and here he's no different. He's a very unlikely romantic interest, and in fact, for the first while, he's not a romantic interest at all. He's the pharmacist from whom Kate gets drugs that she isn't technically supposed to, but she wins prescriptions and things that she's not supposed to at card games, and he knows perfectly well what's going on. But as she begins her treatment, he soon realizes that these aren't just recreational drugs, and they have a very deep conversation, or slowly it kind of bonds because it transpires that he has had a wife who has died from cancer, so he becomes this very, very supportive character in her life, and he's the one who suggests this fly fishing as a bonding exercise, which is what brings the other women into her life outside of a hospital setting in a meaningful way, and that's really where the film takes off, and you get all the jokes that Daryl thought he shouldn't be listening to.
Yes, and as Daryl said, the various characters in the chemo group come from very different social milieu, and in this clip, a fellow cancer patient, Fiona McKenna, played by Karen Egan, offers to drop Kate home in a taxi, and they get into a chat involving the taxi driver, who's played by Gary Mountain.
Come on, Kate, jump in. I'll drop you home.
No, you're all right.
Oh, get in, for God's sake.
Good
complete waste of time. You do realize that, don't you? What? Suicide. I read recently that of the 29 people who survived throwing themselves off the Golden Gate Bridge, every single one of them reported regretting it the moment their hands left the railings.
Thank you for that, Fiona. I'll keep it in mind the next time I try to top myself.
You could joke all you like. Feeling is healing. Of course, they've always understood that in the East. They know there's no escape from emotional pain.
She's right, love. I'm a Buddhist myself. If you don't deal with your shite in this life, then you're going to have to come back and deal with it in the next.
Correct.
Jesus wept.
Goodness, you're very enlightened.
You're very patronising.
You don't actually believe that crap, do you?
I'm just saying. They know a thing or two, those holy men.
Bang on.
Then I'm really fucked.
There, sorry about that bad language. They're from The Bright Side. So, Daryl, overall, how did you think it worked? I mean, it's a strange mix, a cancer story and comedy.
That's right. I was with it for much of the way. But I had this feeling, as I get with a lot of comedies and even kind of independent, low budget comedies, that the film was fighting against its own cliches and particularly, I think, fighting against its own imposed structure. It's yet another of these comedies that's sort of weighed down like an anchor by an enforced film structure that I suppose it gets from screenwriting class. You know, there's the setup. There's a distinct act. There's the growing relationship that begins mistrustfully and you know, grows into affection and love. There's a conflict that temporarily sunders that relationship and it ends with a resolution of that conflict. This isn't giving anything away because we've seen this structure many, many times. So it's almost as though the film is assembled and it really doesn't help, I don't think. You know, the what's good about this film is its sense of quirky individualism. And so I thought it was fighting against that.
And for stars for The Bright Side, Daryl?
Well, I think it's fair to say that I'm not really the target audience for this film, but 3.5.
3.5. And fighting its own cliches, Tara, do you agree?
I think the characters did feel like something that could be extended out to a TV series length, and that you didn't really get enough time to sit with each of the characters for them to develop properly. And I do think it did, as Daryl says, felt a little bit cookie cutter in its approach. But I did like that it had the courage to put, you know, proper dark comedy in its heroine's mouth in particular. I would also say 3.5.
3.5 for both of you for The Bright Side. Next up, Pig, the debut feature film from director Michael Saranowski, who has also co-written the script, and the movie stars Nicolas Cage. Daryl, this is a movie's very interesting premise. Tell us about the pig in question and Robert Field as much as you can, the pig's owner.
Yeah, I almost can't believe I'm about to explain the premise of this film. So Nicolas Cage is Rob Feld, who's a truffle hunter, who lives alone in a cabin in the Oregon woods with his beloved pig. And the pig is stolen, very shockingly from him one day. So he heads to Portland, the nearest big city, to get it back. And he goes there with the aid of Alex Wolff's character, who is the sort of flash young man that he sells his truffles to. And over the course of the film and over the course of a number of scenes in the film, he meets various characters from his past, and we get to discover things about his past, including that he is or was Robin Feld, a legendary chef who had disappeared a decade ago, and no one had heard anything from him since after the death of his wife.
So, Tara, as foodies would know, truffles are amongst the most expensive mm-hmm. ingredients in the high-end restaurants. So how does the film, or is this the purpose of the film, to make that connection of this pure existence Robin is having, living with his pig, searching for truffles, and then the high-end cutthroat business of restaurants in Portland, the capital city of Oregon?
Well, it does. It certainly does make merry with that contrast. Although it's a little bit more, it is a little bit more somber than that description would suggest. It kind of creates that dichotomy. But really, it's about, you know, living a life of bad faith or not being true to yourself. And we get that in several key scenes, including one that Robin, played by Nicolas Cage, has with a former chef that worked with him, who was opened one of these very hipster haute cuisine type restaurants when the chef in question really wanted to open a pub. I mean, that one of the many things that the film does is that it sets up things like that and then sort of pulls the rug right out from under them. So you get that premise that immediately seems to be part of that kind of Cage rage, that memes that we've come to see over the last few years, where we see this kind of very angry, vengeful Nicolas Cage in films like Mom and Dad or Mandy or Color Out of Space, and it sets the film up to be that, you know, he's out to get his pig, but then it's not that film at all. It's a much more resting film than that.
Sorry, Tara, if we could just go back to that scene, because we have a clip of that. So you're talking that we first of all meet Nicolas Cage and he's the recluse. Then you're thinking perhaps he's going to be a vengeful Nicolas Cage. And then all of a sudden he's kind of a truthsayer, as he is in this clip where he goes to Chef Finway's ultra fancy Portland eatery. This Nicolas Cage as Robin was his former boss, and he begins to question Chef Finway about his practice.
What is the concept here?
We're interested in taking local ingredients native to this region and just deconstructing them, you know, making the familiar feel foreign, thereby giving us an even greater appreciation of food as a whole.
This is the kind of cooking you like?
It's cutting edge. It's very exciting.
Exciting.
I mean, everybody loves it.
You like cooking it?
Absolutely.
Derek, what was it you always used to talk about opening? Wasn't it a pub?
Everyone loves it here. This is a huge success.
Why didn't you open your pub?
I don't know that I really wanted. That was such a long time ago.
When I fired you, I asked you what you wanted to do. You said you have a few rooms upstairs. A real English pub.
Did I say that?
Yes.
Nobody wants pubs around here. It's just a terrible investment.
What was going to be your signature dish?
Liver scotch eggs with a honey curry mustard.
There, Robin, played by Nicolas Cage, and Chef Finway, played by David Nell. And they're sitting in a very chic restaurant, all foam, froth and jus. And there is Nicolas Cage, Daryl, sitting with a bloodied head after he's been involved in some awful kind of fight club at the bottom of a building in Oregon. What Tara is saying there is Is it a playful, simple drama? Is it a commentary? Is it a tragedy? What exactly is the film saying about life, about cooking, about natural products?
Well, at its best, in the scene that you've just played, which I second Tara's emotion about that, it's a fantastic scene, and you know, hats off to David Nell for a wonderful cameo performance there. I think
yes,
at its
terrific.
Best, this is a film about authenticity, a film about what's real. We don't get a lot of things to care about, is one of the things that Rob says to Fenway, and so that's what the film is trying to be about. But it's also, I mean, sometimes I think films can be just a little bit too strange and quirky. for their own good. And I sometimes feel with this that it's trying a little bit too hard to be a different, to be an unusual, to be a surprising film. Full of these startling scenes, as you say, the kind of restaurant workers' fight club scene, for example. It's not a bad film at all, and it's a film of brilliant moments. But I just thought it was less than the sum of its parts. So I don't know in the end. It's a film, and I thought about it quite a lot afterwards. And it's a film that has an air of profundity about it. But that sort of dissipated for me as soon as I stopped watching the film.
And Tara, everybody will be looking at Nicolas Cage's performance. And as you say, it's a much more subdued and nuanced performance mm-hmm. than we've had of in more recent films.
Yeah, there is this sense, I think, because he's so, cartoonish in certain roles that he's not a great actor. And he himself has characterized his own acting as mega acting. That's his phrase. But in fact, he's an actor with great range. And he often puts me in mind of, that old quote from Sunset Boulevard, it's not. It's not that Nicolas Cage got small; it's that the movies got small, and that the current kind of movies they make don't really suit him. This film actually, and again, it's to do with the way the film is structured and the way that it's consistently surprising, which worked really well for me. I have to say, is that it sort of sets Cage up to turn into the kind of mega acting Cage that we've come to know in recent years, and in fact he never really gets there. There's where he ends up is somewhere I would say quite profoundly sad and very moving. He keeps moving back into these sort of quieter places, even though he's presented in this very cartoonish way. You keep expecting in every scene that someone's going to clean the blood off his head, but that never happens. And we should say congratulations, in particular, to the continuity department that had to keep that dried blood on his head all the way through the film, and the makeup department as well. I mean, those people definitely deserve an Oscar.
So stars out of five for the makeup department, Nicolas Cage and the pig that disappears far too early, I think.
Yeah, I would give this five. I absolutely loved it. I enjoyed every second, and I loved the element of surprise.
Okay, 5 out of 5 for Pig from Tara. And from you, Daryl?
Maybe I'm just too literal-minded here. I can't believe that someone as dishevelled-looking, as you say, caked in blood and frankly filthy as Rob would ever be allowed a table in the most fashionable restaurant in Portland. And I kept thinking, isn't he just too smelly to eat with? So I wanted him. I know it's the point, but I kept expecting him and wanting him to go all kind of postal and John Wick and do something genuinely horrible with a chef's knife. So I was rather disappointed when he didn't. So I guess 3.5 for me.
3.5. Well, I just love the scene where he made the beautiful mushroom tart. I thought I saw a completely different side of Nicolas Cage. So let's move on to our final movie, Censor, starring Niamh Algar, who we were delighted to have on the show last week. This is set in Britain in 1985, where Niamh Algar plays the titular role of the film censor, who discovers a horror movie and the plot of which demonstrates uncanny parallels with the disappearance of her sister. This link that she is determined to explore. Tara, this is a movie set in Thatcher's Britain, and mm-hmm. it's the frenzy at the time is about video nasties and how the nasties might be propelling people to get involved in crime.
Yeah, and I think people forget how hysterical that was, we have the equivalent of the satanic panic in the United States, and we had the video nasty hysteria over here, and it was a big collective frenzy that was running in tabloids all the time.
there were reports that were very keen to link every single crime with some video release, and we ended up with some, you know, genuine horror classics like The Evil Dead were banned at that time. So the film straight away is very voguish because it immediately tips into very contemporary debates about internet censorship that are ongoing. And as you said, it stars Niamh Alghar as Enid. She's a very prim young woman. She works in the as a censor, which was actually the classification board in 1985. They'd already changed its name in Britain. The film has some fun with her professionalism and the kind of trashy movies she creates. You hear her discussing her job, as if one would with paperclip surprise, going, "Well, we've salvaged the tug of war with the intestines." So the film's having fun from the start. But it's also quite creepy from the start because, you know, here she is. She sees herself as this kind of guardian, moral guardian, or protector of the public psyche. But when her parents inform her that they've declared her sister, who was long lost in the girl's childhood, she disappeared years earlier. And when the parents tell her that they've had the sister declared legally dead in order to have some closure, she's clearly very, very upset. And back at work, while watching this very cheap exploitation video called "Don't Go Into the Church," which is a very good approximation of what the kind of cheaper videos of the 1980s looked like, she becomes convinced that the leading actress that she sees in that video is her now grown up sister. And she then reaches out to the film's very, very sleazy producer, which is like this wonderful odious turn from Irish actor Michael Smiley, in the hope of tracking down the film's mysterious director. So it has this really, really terrific setup, and it has lots and lots of talking points right off the bat, which is one of the reasons it's one of the most talked about films to emerge from Britain this year.
Okay, let's listen to a clip from the beginning of the film. What you said that they were having fun about trying to make rather disrespectful films a bit more respectful. We meet Enid, played by Niamh Alghar, and Sanderson, played by Nicholas Burns, at the beginning of the film, debating what should go and what should stay in the latest horror film they're looking at.
I'm not still going over it.
Well, if we're passing it as an 18, it needs more cuts.
The decapitation?
Nope. No, the decapitation is ridiculous. It's the eye gouging. It's too realistic. Plus, I was trying to see who dragged her away.
Does it matter?
Oh, it would be nice if it had some clear retribution.
I appreciate you analysing this with such precision, Enid, but perhaps someone got out of the cautious side of bed this morning?
Oh, I'm just doing my job.
You're missing the intellectual layer, my
come head. On, we
the
both
The heightened saw. References take the edge off the more realistic violence. See it less as an eye-gouging, more part of a grand tradition. It's no worse than the Cyclops in Homer. It's Gloucester in Lear. It's un chien andalou.
Salvaged the tug of war with the intestines. I've kept in most of the screwdriver stuff. And I've only trimmed the tiniest bit off the end of the genitals. But some things should be left to the imagination.
It's like rat brothel all over again.
No, I just want to get it right. Plus, you lost the argument the moment you brought Shakespeare into the room. We can't afford to make mistakes. I'm cutting it.
Niamh Alghar there playing Enid, and Sanderson, who has notions, is played by Nicholas Burns. So Tara set the scene there, Darrell, but then as the film progresses and reality and the film world becomes a little more meshed, we literally step into the horror films of the 1980s. This is a more difficult section of the film. How does that work?
I think it works very well indeed. It's a film that took me back in very many ways. But it's a film that, as you say, gets increasingly more sort of phantasmagoric, more hallucinatory as it goes on until Enid sort of finds herself starring in a Frederick North film, a film made by this kind of reclusive shock director. And you know, it's there's a conflation of reality and fiction going on here. In the same way that the video nasty debates were playing with the ideas, or were confronting the ideas of how can we tell reality from fiction, which is more dangerous? Can fiction infect reality? Can watching these films make you perform the actions of these films? So it's a film that explores these overlapping territories then of memory and amnesia, of trauma and violence, of censorship and editing. You know, it's all going on here. And one of the lessons and this is, I think, a highly intellectual film, like all the best horror really is. And one of the lessons, I think, very clearly that one might draw from this film is that the censors might be actually more dangerous than the horror films that they try to censor.
And you, in your own academic life, are steeped in Gothic and in the horror genres. So you were very impressed by this, this isn't just a horror film. It digs deep into an understanding of the genre and film in general.
I think it does. Yeah, I'm afraid that like Nicholas Burns, when we've just heard that, I have also made these kinds of pretentious sounding arguments about the history of horror going back, and the history of these depraved and violent images going right back to classical antiquity. So the film is very, very well aware of all of these, but it's also a film which comes out of a specific time, as Tara suggested, in British history. So that in some way the figure of Margaret Thatcher looms over this, when we see her in film clips. We see the miners' strike going on in the background, in which there is actual state-sanctioned violence and brutality going on around her. And the question that the video nasties debate then asks with hindsight is, to what extent was this a kind of smokescreen, a kind of deflection from the real issues? What is really depraving and corrupting in British society at the time? And in her sort of prim and conservative and highly moralistic way, Enid the Censor has a touch of the Margaret Thatchers about her, I think.
I'm expecting a high score here, Daryl, out of five.
Five.
Five out of five. What about you, Tara?
I really loved it. I think it's really beautifully crafted, especially for production design, costume design, all those things. I think structurally, when it's who will watch the Watchmen, and it conflates reality and fantasy in the way that it does, it can only really go one way. So I would say it sort of ends up exactly where you expect it to. But I think it's a very, very impressive piece of work. Four
out of five, and five out of five. That's for Censor. And the other film we reviewed was Pig and The Bright Side. And that's Tara Brady and Darryl Jones. Thank you so much. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Things Are Against Us is the first essay collection by the novelist Lucy Ellman. Her last book, Ducks, Newburyport, made headlines in 2019 for its form, a 1,000-page epic in one long sentence. It was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Fans of her fiction will recognise some of the concerns that crop up in the essays, including women's bodies and women's place in society, served with a large dollop of humour to get us through the trauma. Elsewhere, she tackles Doris Day, Alfred Hitchcock, teenagers, makeover channels and crime fiction, and yes, men, all with gusto, humour and deadly seriousness. Alex Clark has been reading it for us, and she's with me now in studio. Alex, you're very welcome.
Hello.
Can you just reintroduce us to Lucy Ellman? She's written six novels, beginning with Sweet Desserts in 1988, but then Ducks, Newburyport was the one that made her name.
Exactly.
Much, much later.
Exactly. And I've read her books throughout her career, always enormously enjoyed them. And then Ducks, Newburyport, this 1,000-page plus one-sentence novel about, a housewife and mother baking one day in her home. And it was as if Lucy Ellman was saying, you complain about there being domestic novels, let me show you what domestic really means. It couldn't have been more domestic. And it also had that touch, which we see in the essays, of the homage to Virginia Woolf, one of her kind of natural forebears, I think.
All right. And the one that relates to Virginia Woolf particularly in this is called Three Strikes. And it's a modern take on Three Guineas, is that right? Which was a Virginia Woolf essay.
Yes, that's right. Virginia Woolf's 1938 essay, Three Guineas, about very many of the same concerns, the great political unrest of the time and how women sidelining in the concerns of the day, their marginalised lives are ill-serving the whole of humanity.
And is she making a genuine connection in the essay, or is it somebody like you can see the connection between the two?
Well, she cites Virginia Woolf. We know that it's there, and she follows this idea of the ways that we attack patriarchy. I mean, Lucy Ellman, you know, the way that she speaks, the way that she writes, she dices all the time with this kind of extreme flippancy. In many ways, you know, her tone is not very much like that more sort of refined humour of Virginia Woolf. She makes us think all the time that she's just larking about. It's kind of freewheeling. She did it to an extent in Ducks Newburyport too, and has done in all of her work. So it's kind of played for comic effect, these three strikes, sorry, housework, labour force, and sex. And she immediately says it's great. It's we're going to take over the world here, and we're going to put things back to rights. When you get underneath all these arguments, they are so much more serious, and they are so much more substantial than a lot of her comic tone initially makes you believe. And I think that's the kind of great trick, the great conceit, the great kind of skill of it.
And is she saying in ways that we haven't come much further than what Virginia Woolf wrote about?
Well, I think one of the things I thought about the very satirical moments in many of these essays, which are a collection, you know, some of them are new, some of them go right back. There's one about the tyranny of bras that goes right back to 2000. So she's really talking about great hyperbole. You know, these are the things that unites them. She makes these kind of enormous cases that we shouldn't have electricity, for example, that we shouldn't go anywhere ever. And it reminded me of that kind of idea of somebody like Jonathan Swift making, you know, a modest proposal that is so ridiculous, that is so hyperbolic. It takes you as the reader to the place where you suddenly think, well, I'm rejecting it, but what am I left with if we don't reject this? The situation that we're in now is just as ridiculous, just as dreadful.
Yes, because the lost art of staying put is what you're talking about when she's against travel. And I suppose it's an obtuse way of getting at concerns that we're dealing with today about climate change and pandemics. But she makes an argument against the car, against the plane, in that very humorous way.
Yes, and that idea, of course, that there is something so metaphysically, philosophically, emotionally wrong about constantly wanting to be somewhere else. And what I like about her writing particularly is that we've heard that before, haven't we? This idea of kind of be in the moment and don't take selfies all the time, actually see things. But she takes it so much further, and then she actually puts things under a much kind of finer sort of lens, a much finer microscope. And she is really saying, What do you want to see? Why do you want to see these things? What are you talking about? And it does actually make you think, what am I talking about? And it's kind of counterintuitive in a year where we're all sort of desperate to go somewhere, anywhere.
Yes, because she argues that if you are going to these places, you're going and it is so curated already that you almost, you know what you're going to see, or you're seeing it through the eyes of the brochures and the books you've read about a place.
That's right. And you have already sort of define what your experience is going to be, perhaps. I mean, she, as I say, you know, she takes it hyperbolically far all the time. So she, you know, you might think, well, yes, but my partner lives on the other side of the world, my family, or whatever. And she just says, well, get your loved ones nearer to you.
You can't get a tan in Ireland. So one of my favourite ones was her interrogation of Hitchcock's fairly underrated film Spellbound with Gregory Peck and Ingrid Bergman, both playing psychiatrists. And Peck comes to Ingrid Bergman, he's in trouble. And Ellman decides to probe the film, saying, oh, I think Hitchcock is actually turned the tables here on his bad reputation towards women, that he's very positive towards Bergman.
Yes, that's right. He's kind of saying, look at this psychiatrist, psychoanalyst here, stuck with this guy. She's got to make him better somehow. Of course, the obligatory kind of romance comes in. But, you know, she is actually a woman who's doing all this stuff in a ridiculously male-dominated world. And of course, when you think back to Spellbound, you think, yes, that is there. I do see it. But she spells it out for you very, very clearly.
Of course, it got me running back to the film today. And we found a clip where we meet Bergman very early on. And she comes up against a fellow doctor. And they have a conversation where he kind of ends up hitting on her.
Murchison must be really out of his mind to assign Carmichael to you.
Well, you may report your findings to the new head when he arrives.
You can't treat a love veteran like Carmichael without some inside information.
I have done a great deal of research on emotional problems and love difficulties.
Research by eye. I've watched your work for 6 months. It's brilliant but lifeless. There's no intuition in it. You approach all your problems with an ice pack on your head.
Are you making love to me?
Well, in a moment. I'm just clearing the ground first. I'm trying to convince you that your lack of human and emotional experience is bad for you as a doctor. And fatal for you as a woman.
I've heard that argument from a number of amorous psychiatrists who all wanted to make a better doctor of me.
Ah, but I've got a much better argument. I'm terribly fond of you.
There, Dr. Peterson, played by Ingrid Bergman, having none of the affections of John Emery, who plays Dr. Fleureau. Is she saying something new about that film, do you think?
Well, I think she just has that eye that makes you go back to it. And I think this is what happens. I found my own thoughts kind of turned back on themselves. There's a kind of particularly wonderful bit where she, you know, it's almost a sort of example of women always getting the thick end of the wedge, where Ingrid Bergman's character has to go skiing in order to provoke a reaction in Gregory Peck because he's terribly traumatised by an accident that's happened. And she says, you should never, ever go skiing in films. It's a bad idea. Then again, she was Swedish, so she had a head start. And that kind of thing obviously is not a deep piece of criticism, but it's very funny and it brings you into the rest of what she's thinking.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really, really, really funny piece. Then we go from Europe and a psychoanalysis into the Wild West and Laura Ingalls. Laura Ingalls Wilder, who of course people will know, was the woman who wrote Little House on the Prairie. And the name of the title of that essay is The Woman of the House. So what does she say about Laura Ingalls Wilder?
Well, I think what was particularly interesting to me about reading this essay was, you know, as somebody obviously sort of, you grow up with watching it on the telly, then you're aware of lots of the story around Laura Ingalls' life. I read the books when I was a child too, but it was the relationship between her and her daughter, Laura Ingalls Wilder and Rose Wilder Lane, that was so interesting because essentially Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote much, much later in her life. Her writing, as Lucy Ellman says, kind of got better as she progressed through these series of books. But she was almost had to get through the kind of gatekeeper of her daughter, and it's a fascinating kind of portrait. But of course, she does also talk about the issues around that kind of writing, that colonial imperialist writing, the idea of the conquering of the West, the idea of the white settlers subjugating the indigenous peoples. She talks about it very, very interestingly.
And when you say the daughter was a gatekeeper, what do you mean?
Well, there's a point at which she cites her kind of getting some more of her mother's writing and saying something like, God, I'm going to have to go through this all again. You know, there was this idea that it was somehow felt funneled through. Laura, you know, relied in some ways on her daughter's kind of opinion, relied on her to steer her through the publication progress. Did she really need that? We're not so sure by the conclusion of this essay.
So, Alex, it sounds like you liked the collection, or was there unevenness in it?
I think with a collection rather than something that's absolutely bespoke, you often feel that you're kind of zipping around. I think that we also, you know, realise that there is something that unites all these, a lot of it, something I haven't talked about quite so much is that idea as in the Underground Bunker essay, you know, which is about her rage at America, her fury at America, a country that she says is essentially like a giant internment camp for women. And it is so kind of scathingly written that I think it actually carries quite a lot of the book. But I did enjoy the book throughout.
Well, my thanks to Alex Clark. Things Are Against Us by Lucy Ellman is published by Gallery Beggar Press. Thanks, Alex. The Dublin Fringe Festival returns next month to Dublin and will include more than 160 performances of 30 events at 16 venues. Last year's festival managed to squeeze in between the worst of the lockdowns, and after an extremely challenging period for live performances, which we spoke about last night, the 27th edition of the Dublin Fringe will have 26 world premieres plus 3 Dublin premieres. Malaprop Theatre's new work for this year's festival is called Where Sat the Lovers. It's about facing an overwhelming world and trying to make sense of it all, which we are all trying to do indeed. I'm joined by the director, Claire O'Reilly. Claire, you're very welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Kay. How are you?
Now, this was originally designed for the Carlow Arts Festival, but because of restrictions, it became a WhatsApp show. How did it work and where did it go from there?
That's right. It was Carlow and Cork Midsummer as well. Actually, we're doing it as part of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival next week, so you can still do it. That was Epistles, and it became a sort of digital companion piece to Where Sat the Lovers, because we knew enough about Where Sat the Lovers, the live stage show, to know that it wasn't quite going to work or to stream it or film it. So yeah, Epistles came about, and it was a really exciting way to work because we were developing Where Sat the Lovers anyway. So we just got to really collaboratively make this WhatsApp show with lots of different voice notes and videos and kind of extra research around our characters and the setting that we explore anyway.
Okay, tell us about the characters. There are three characters, two sisters and one who is in a bit of trouble. Tell us about the story.
So, yeah, well, where's that? It's about lots of things. But yeah, at its core, there's this person who needs to understand everything around them in order to feel safe. And yeah, they live in a one-bedroom flat with their sister, and that's kind of where our action primarily takes place. And their sister thinks they may have schizoaffective disorder. And the show sort of explores how they relate to, yeah, those they love or could love eventually, and how they make sense of the world as they see it.
Right. And then the opening scene, there's the character. The characters are called E, F and G. And in the beginning, the characters E and F meet. What are they discussing and who are they? Is that one of the sisters?
One of the siblings, yeah. So our primary character is there, and that's who we follow throughout the whole show. And then they are actually on a first date with another character who we learn more about, I don't want to speak too much about because sort of their identity, and that's all part of how the narrative flows. But yeah, so it's a first date and how they kind of navigate that as these two people who have just met.
Right. It's interesting. Two nights ago, we were talking about a show that deals with conspiracy theories. And again, F is spends a lot of her time looking at conspiracy theories and trying to make sense of them. Tell us about what she's involved in.
Yeah, it's interesting whether F would consider themselves a conspiracy theorist. They're just trying to find patterns in order to feel safe. I suppose we keep coming back to this core idea of how you make sense of the world around you, which is such a long, big, nebulous, complex place at the best of times. And particularly if you are struggling with your mental health in any way, that you can maybe start to form patterns that are sometimes really enlightening and sometimes not always that helpful. And that's why we have this another character who has this sort of surreal quality that kind of we follow throughout as well. And it's kind of the like hallowed remains or theatrical reinterpretation of Isaac Newton, because Isaac Newton as a figure in history is sort of did similar things with great success insofar as finding patterns in places. So yeah, that's kind of what they're up to.
Yes. And at another point, the song Barbie Girl by Aqua becomes a topic of discussion. Let's have a little listen and then we'll chat about that.
You could say I'm always yours. Ooh, you could say I'm always yours. You can say I'm always yours. can say I'm always yours. You can say I'm always yours.
Now, F becomes very angry about this song, What's Wrong with Barbie Girl by Aqua.
Oh, did you think? I'm not sure I interpreted it in that way. It's mostly because, so F is sort of a sibling bone of contention in that when F was growing up with their sibling G, this was a song that was played on loop. And even though I think we can all agree, including F, that Barbie Girl is like a banger, I think it's also one of those weird auto-tune-y type pieces of music that played on loop might get a little bit grating. So I think that that's kind of where that comes from. And it's, I think both... a slightly contentious and also affectionate aspect of their relationship. And I can't believe we listened to Ren Dennehy, the performer playing Isaac, sing all of that. That was so fun.
And what about the siblings, G and F? G is working and F is unemployed. What's the dynamic between them?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complex one because they live in this one bedroom flat in Belfast and they're not from Belfast. And we sort of learned throughout the show a little bit about their family history, which again is layered and difficult. And they love each other. And I think that's evident and it's important to, I mean, any relationship, but also the story. But it's strained and it's difficult. And they're both, I mean, we've spoken about F, who, you know, is maybe struggling in a slightly more overt way, or we might perceive that as a more overt way. But G also has, you know, they have quite a difficult family history. And so G's also trying to find safety in a very different way that maybe also isn't very helpful. So, yeah, it's about exploring different ways of.
And are you looking forward to being back in front of an audience?
Oh, we can't wait. Yeah, buzzing.
Well, that's great. Well, welcome back to The Fringe. My thanks to Claire O'Reilly. Where Sat the Lovers is part of the Dublin Fringe Festival with performances at the Project Arts Centre from the 22nd to the 25th of September. More details at fringefest.com. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. Mark Dwyer was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator and tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan.